and maybe we will question.
Yes, but maybe. Right, okay.
I wanted to ask.
Let's see.
You.
Oh, me.
Anything of that nature.
That the community.
Of society, you mean?
Society.
Ah, I'm sorry. I thought you were talking about Sangha.
It is as if there was no Sangha.
Okay. Let me try to rephrase it in terms of what I think I said. I think what my sense is that the Buddha had a very large vision of what human life could be, and this had two dimensions: a spiritual dimension, which involves meditation and reflection and understanding oneself and ethics and so on. But I feel he also had a vision of the kind of society that he thought could be possible in his world. And I think the comment you're referring to is when I said that historically Buddhism has emphasized very much the spiritual transformation of the individual, but has done very little in terms of translating that vision into a social vision, or even less, a social practice. Is that what I was... That is what I think you must be referring to.
I think you even said once the same about rationality.
Mm.
I think that another thing is really a kind of disillusion of the reduction and I thought that it's kind of interesting the fact that also the social aspect.
That's right, yeah. So, no, that's the other side of that, is that...
Because, you know, you said that if the Buddha had been sitting by himself as an
emperor, oh, right, yeah,
content, then he would not have been so...
That's right, yeah. Yeah, that's the other point. Okay, so that's the point you're referring to. The fact that Buddha's... The story of the Buddha is presented entirely as though he basically had no contact with anybody else. He was sitting, he was meditating on nothingness, or he was starving himself. That to me is not a very sufficient basis for being able to explain this extraordinarily detailed and well thought out theory that he subsequently evolved. And I think it possibly does play into the fact that in the West, part of the attraction to Buddhism has been has come together with a disillusion with rationality and a disillusion with learning and knowledge and so forth, and a turn towards one might say a more spiritually fulfilled inner life, and in doing so perhaps retreating from the necessity of social participation and engagement. Yes, if I may, I'd rather leave these questions till the end of the week, when I'm going to look at them very... I'm building up a story, as it were, that will enable us, when we come to next Wednesday, to be able to then see how this would inform a social and a communal dimension, as well as a spiritual one. And this is why I'm emphasizing trying to get back to the beginnings, the earliest ideas, the core ideas, I feel, and on that basis trying to build up another kind of superstructure that does not copy or imitate forms of Buddhism that have come down to us, that tries to reconstruct something from the ground up. And that, I think, necessarily entails an equal valuing of spiritual and social. A lot of people who talk about engaged Buddhism take Buddhism in its various forms as a kind of given, whether it's Zen or Tibetan Buddhism or Theravada Buddhism, and then, as it were, build on top of that a kind of social philosophy. I'm not sure that's workable in the long term. I feel that one needs to critically reconsider a lot of the ideas that have become taken for granted in Buddhism over the centuries, and try to get back to a foundation from which to, in a sense, rebuild the house from the ground up. But we'll come back to that. It's a good point, and I'll probably keep referring to it. Yes.
I think it's the original text of the Buddha.
The original text of the Buddha, yeah.
I just was wondering what you mean by that. So, and I know a lot of people say what the Buddha said, what the Buddha thought.
It's a very good question. And I'll try to be as brief as possible. I think we do need to address this point. It's certainly true. You can pick up any number of books on Buddhism and it'll say the Buddha said X, the Buddha said Y, the Buddha said Z, and very often there's no reference, or sometimes there'll just be a name of some long complicated sutra in Sanskrit or something which you've never heard of. Now every Buddhist school believes traditionally that its sutra are the word of the Buddha, whether it's the Mahayana text or Pali text. I would look at this much more in terms of what we have come to understand through historical critical research in Buddhist studies, which in many respects follows the methodologies of biblical criticism that have developed in the last couple of hundred years in the West. And on that basis, can I think say with some confidence is that the body of texts that are most close to what the Buddha himself would have said, the historical Buddha, Siddhartha Gautama, are found in the collections called the Pali Canon and the Chinese Agama literature. Don't worry so much about the Chinese Agamas. But what we have in Pali and in Chinese translation from early Sanskrit, we have two bodies of discourses, both containing pretty much the same material. There are hundreds of sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya, the middle-length discourses, the ones I've been quoting from. There are 152 discourses. In English, and they all exist in translation in English now, it's four or five thick volumes of about 1,000 pages each. Now within that there's an awful lot of repetition, an awful lot of stuff that you probably wouldn't find very interesting. But we do find within that a consistent body of knowledge that contains a coherent and consistent account of certain historical figures and places and times. And it's that body of material that I consider to be the word of the Buddha. The Mahayana texts, like the Heart Sutra, the Diamond Sutra, the Lotus Sutra, I do not consider to be the word of the Buddha, the word of the historical Buddha. These are texts written in Sanskrit 500 years later, roughly, that do not give you anything like the sense of historical reality that you find in the Pali texts. So I'm not saying these texts have no value. They often contain great insights and wisdom that are entirely consistent with everything you find in the Pali texts, but I think it's unacceptable to say that these are the words of the Buddha. So when I say the word of the Buddha, therefore, I'm referring to basically the Pali texts. It's true, as you say, that these were not written down in the Buddha's time. They were not written down, in fact, for about 300 or 400 years Now, for many of us today, we'll think, well, come on, it's a bit like if Shakespeare's plays were only written down at the beginning of the 20th century. We would say, well, these are probably not the things that Shakespeare wrote. But that, I think, is an assumption made from the point of view of a culture that is so committed to the literary form that we find it very difficult to imagine how an oral culture could preserve itself without corruption. But I think we have to acknowledge that in Indian tradition and in other non-Western traditions, we have oral teachings that are held as very valuable and precious sources of the culture and the civilization. And I think there's a high degree of commitment to preserving literally out of these texts. The same with the Vedas, the Upanishads, all of these were remembered orally long before, hundreds of years before they were written down. The Buddha himself seems to have been aware of the problem of the survival of his teachings. And already shortly after the Buddha's death, in the first council, you have the monks gathering together and dividing parts of the canon to different monastic groups. The emphasis has always been that these texts were recited communally. If you just have one person sitting in a cave, spending his whole time reciting hundreds of pages of text, then yes, there's a lot of room for error and forgetting. If you have a group of monks or nuns, you know, regularly sitting down and reciting things in unison, that I think already gives a certain safety. The most telling reason, well, there are two reasons really, for having confidence in these texts is going back as close as one can hope to the Buddha himself, is that the material in the Pali canon and the material in the Chinese Agamas are essentially identical. There are variants and so on. They're not word for word the same. Two bodies of material were remembered hundreds of miles apart. The Pali canon was remembered in Western India initially and then by monks in Sri Lanka before it was written down. The Chinese Agama material was remembered in Sanskrit in northeast India by another group of monks of different schools and was then translated into Chinese around the 4th century. When you compare the two bodies of text, they are essentially identical. Now that to me is a very striking fact. It shows that there was a commitment to preserving exactly the content of this material that was able to be achieved over hundreds of years. The other indication for me that's very compelling regarding authenticity is that throughout the Pali texts you have scattered little historical details of kings here and a king there and a merchant here and a Brahmin there. And when you put all these little bits together, it makes complete coherent sense. You get a consistent historical narrative of the events of the Buddha's life. Now, I can't imagine how anyone could have somehow interpolated that material later. The most economical reason or argument for its consistency is the fact that these bits, although they were not important in terms of the Dharma, were nonetheless preserved, and when you take them out now, they still make coherent sense. To me, that points again to a certain integrity of that material. Those are my basic argument, but obviously there's a lot of research that that still needs to be done into this matter. But for myself, I will, when I say the Buddha said, I'm referring to canonical texts within the Pali tradition, not to commentaries or to Buddha Ghosha, but to what is actually either in the suttas or in the Vinaya, the text about the monastic rule.
The question over there?
Yes.
The independent origination and the fact that everything that arises ceases,
yeah,
as a basis, and then actually nothing can be separate and we're all just part of this interdependent, interconnected.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems to me that the only way then...
Let's look at this word transcendence. The Buddha certainly seeks transcendence. But we have to be careful in understanding transcendence as the transcendence of something. In the same way, when we speak about enlightenment, the word in itself has really no meaning until we understand enlightened about what. The enlightened about what comes down to dependent origination. When we say transcendence, what are we transcending? We are transcending, it's very clear in the Buddhist text, that we transcend greed and hatred and confusion. But there's no sense that there is something called the transcendent. A transcendental experience, which is a language I'm slightly uncomfortable with, would only make sense if we understand what the world would be like, what our experience would be like when it's not motivated or driven by greed or by hatred or by bewilderment. Any experience of the world that's not coming from those places is an experience that has transcended greed and hatred and delusion. Now, in many respects, that does break down a lot of the narrow divisions that we impose on the web of life. The sense that greed and hatred and delusion are founded on the idea that there are things out there in the world that I can possess, there are other things that I can get rid of, and the rest of it I don't really have to care about. That's the greed, hatred, delusion strategy, with which we're probably all somewhat familiar. When that begins to break down, then our relationship to the world becomes a very different one. And if you want, we can call that transcendent, but I wouldn't. I find the word transcendent has so many other meanings in our language that it adds more confusion than it takes away. So to that extent, yes, I can speak of transcendence. The idea that everything is interrelated with everything else is again a very beautiful poetic expression of the kind of world in which we're not committed to division and segregation and difference. But I would not go as far as saying that we then experience the world or everything as being one. That is a language that's quite alien to the Buddha. And he also certainly does not wish to point to an experience in which there is no self. I think that's not what the Buddha taught. And again, at the end of the week, we'll come back to this question. But my own sense is that in letting go of greed, of hatred, and of delusion, it's through that one finds the capacity to become what one can be, rather than just a person or a being who is repeating the same confused behaviors and solidifying an ego. You free yourself to create a person, a character, an individuality that is highly differentiated. I don't believe the Buddha is talking about the elimination of all difference and returning to a kind of primordial unity. Personally, I don't feel that's what he's doing. But I'll come back to these points again and again, because I do think they are important. And hopefully in the course of the next days this will become more clarified. What's the name? I don't know which hand went up first. You.
Me?
Yes, you.
Hi. It relates a little bit to what you said. From my experience.
Yeah.
So, what did you say about it? And anyway, what I kind of...
It did create God.
It created God.
Sorry, what did?
Like everybody knows, everybody plans, everybody knows.
Uh-huh.
If...
I'm not sure I do actually. But let's go to the first point. The Buddha emphasizes very much that there is no kind of permanent core lying at the heart of the individual person. We think and we feel that there's something within us. I think and feel that there's a sort of...
But then if I ask myself, who is the meditator?
Yes.
It's not the one that thinks, it's not the one that stands up things, and, not that in my own experience, in your, I don't know.
This way. In saying that in deconstructing the sense of I, or self, the Buddha is not thereby demolishing any sense of you or me. What he's pointing to is to another way of understanding and experiencing who I am, who you are. Not as some kind of permanent thing tucked away inside here somewhere that doesn't change or doesn't appear to change, but rather the self is revealed to be an ongoing story, is how I find it helpful to speak of this. That in a way that our lives become like the lives of a character in a novel or in a play. That we're continuously learning things, we're continuously encountering conflicts and resolving them. And it's that ongoing narrative, that ongoing story, that is you. That there doesn't have to be a sort of some little homunculus, some little miniature Stephen, tucked behind the scenes, a kind of spectator who watches this going on. That, I think, is illusory. And we don't need to look only to Buddhism for that. I think we find that in a lot of modern philosophy, in a lot of sort of scientific research, cognitive science and so on. There is no me in that sense. But that does not mean that I don't exist. Of course I exist. So are you. And it's that continuum of ongoing experience integrated through our memory, through our sense of our body, our mind, our emotions, our projects, where we're heading, all of that constitutes quite legitimately a differentiated individuality called you or me or Stephen or John or Mary or whoever.
So in rebirthing, what happens then?
Well, this is the problem. You see, the rebirth thing actually makes... I don't believe in rebirth. So I don't have a problem with that. I think it's... I find it an idea that doesn't make sense to me. The Buddha, you see, also did not want to... He refused to talk about this. I think for very good reasons. Subsequently, Buddhist traditions have all come up with their various theories, usually some subtle consciousness or something, that is able to sneak out of the body when it's dead. I find all that rather fanciful, frankly. So we don't need to go there. Yes. Yes, you. You, okay. Shaking your head.
Actually, I have two questions, and they are connected.
School, yeah.
School, but
Can I just deal with that bit? Very easy. First of all, it's actually incorrect to say that the use of the word Atman is not found in the Theravada tradition in a positive sense. I mean, the Buddha in Pali, the word is Atta, and I'll give some examples at the end of the course, where the Buddha speaks quite affirmatively of Atman, of Atta. Not in the sense it's understood by the Brahmins, but nonetheless, the word Atta, self, is given a positive valuation. Orthodox Theravada tries to deny that. But actually I think that's wrong, and there are good canonical sources, texts, that show the Buddha using the word Atta in a very positive sense. But we'll come back to that. Secondly, Buddha nature. I'm going to give a whole morning's talk on Buddha nature in, I think, on Tuesday. When is it? Any Sunday down the line. So all of the questions you have about Buddha nature will probably, they may not be answered, but they will at least be addressed.
And the second question?
The second question.
Well, actually, it's related to that question.
Incarnated. Yeah.
The common answer often given is we'll attempt to keep our Buddhist worldview intact.
Seen as I go this one.
You see, you can look at this in different ways. I mean, if you want to believe in rebirth and reincarnation, please feel free to do so. This is a free world. At the same time, I think it's very important to see that in Buddhism, reincarnation is not seen as a good thing. It's very important to see that generally Buddhists would not look forward to reincarnation. It's very interesting how human beings now, Buddhist or otherwise actually, see it as a good thing, because they're going, you know, to move up generally, you know, to a better rebirth, hopefully, so with a lot of blessings and things, then, you know, we move up in a good way. But for the Buddha, the idea was to really get out. This, I think, is important to see that. Secondly, in a way, yes, what reincarnates? Everybody, because nobody has gone back to tell us, everybody has very different, in all Buddhist tradition, there are very different things about this rebirth and reincarnation. So I think, again, in a way, this is a belief. And this is a belief, I think, in the same as God. You can't prove it, but you can believe in it if you decide it gives meaning to your life. I think it's very much of that order, the reincarnation. And so I think what we have to maybe look more at is in terms of causality. Because I think causality is that we can experience. And that can make a difference in our life now. And also the Buddha, you see, often I think we see karma as fatalism. Ah, you've got a problem, too bad, that's your karma. You know, mine is a good karma, yours is a bad one. You know, I think this is not the way, in a way, the Buddha understood it. Because, you know, somebody once said to him, it's in one of the sutta, the guy came and said, everything I experience is because of karmic consequences. And the Buddha said, not everything you experience is because of karmic consequences. He said, what you experience can be due to one of eight things. And some of them are physical problem in the body, some of them are to do with the weather, some of them are to do with exhaustion, etc., etc. And the eighth one is karmic consequences. So I think we have to, in a way, not be reductive when we think about karma, causality, rebirth, reincarnation. I think we have to see it in a much more complex way. And very much be careful not to reduce it to fatalism. Because the Buddha this was a departure from his time. That our life was not set at birth. The Buddha was very revolutionary. He said, what you are does not depend upon how you are born, where you are born, which caste or whatever. Your life depends on what you do. And that's why he talks a lot about conditionality. So I think we need to be careful with this idea of reincarnation.
I'm trying to add to that. I don't believe that there is some spiritual bit of me, call it the self if you like, doesn't matter. But you have enormous philosophical and empirical problems in ever understanding what that could possibly mean. The only thing we know for sure that will survive our death are the consequences of our acts. In other words, our karma. Karma means action. It doesn't mean anything other than that. Everything that we do in this life will have an impact on ourselves, on those who are close to us, and ultimately reverberating right throughout the world. We drink a cup of coffee, we buy a car, anything we do will have a consequence, and that will have consequences, and that will have consequences. If I drop dead tomorrow, I don't believe that any spiritual bit of me will go on, but I know for sure, because it seems fairly self-evident, that the actions that I have committed in this life will continue to have effects. And that, I think, is the crucial part about the reincarnation doctrine. The idea of some entity, call it consciousness or spirit or soul or self, doesn't really matter. The function of it is to carry the karmic seeds, as they call them. I don't think we need to bother with the vehicle, a self or a consciousness, but to put the emphasis on the consequences of my and our actions that will outlive us. That is where the moral imperative lies, to act and live in this way such that when we die, we leave the world a better place for those who will come after. That to me is far more important than any theory about something reincarnating. Ah, you know, this gentleman here, yes.
Can you agree that the teaching about Buddhism is a philosophy? Because I read a few different books about explanation of reincarnation, and it's very similar to some university. You know, it makes sense to me because Sukumar said trying to go around and to explain things which you just kind of know about that, you know, by God. So this point of the connection makes me always took me far from those Buddhist books that I was reading. And kind of I like to hear with your explanation that personally I can go well with it. My second question to what you mentioned today about in Buddhism there is right doing or wrong doing, but you say also there is good or bad. I thought there is no good and bad in Buddhism. I thought that good and bad belong to culture. This is sin, this is evil, this is good. Mm. I thought in Buddhism there is only the right doing or the wrong doing. But can you maybe correct me? There also Buddhism, there is the same moral like in doing or evil doing or good doing, or
because
you mentioned
it. No, there is.
But Stephen was trying to say that it is not.
Yeah, I know. I was trying to
please explain.
Do it fast.
Okay.
I think this was a very important thing this morning he said about that it is not absolute thing. This is absolutely good, this is absolutely bad. In terms of some kind of table in the sky. But that it is according to the suffering. I think this is very, very important. That to see certain conditions give rise to suffering and pain, certain conditions doesn't give rise to suffering and pain. And this is according to that, that something will be seen as positive or negative.
Or good or evil. All of these words, right, wrong, good, evil, positive, negative, wholesome, unwholesome, the words the Buddha used are kusala, akusala. Wholesome, unwholesome, skillful, unskillful. But as Asin said, what identifies something as good is whether it leads to well-being and the freedom from suffering. What distinguishes something as negative or evil is what leads to suffering and pain. But this will again be a topic I will address. I'm going to talk about Maya. So we'll come back to this. I think it's an important point. But we'll look at this in another talk. Okay.
Just you, Martin. You spoke about things that, like for example, about when we put our attention today on the body.
Mm-hmm.
The inquiry part is to ask some questions.
I think the inquiry part basically is the way I translate vipassana. And vipassana basically means to look deeply. So if I would say it in a kind of common language, I would say it's experiential looking in. So it's not an inquiry as asking questions in terms of when you sit in meditation and you look into the object. But I see the difference as when you focus, you rest the attention on the object, and when you do vipassana, it's like a beam of light going inside the object so that you experience the object. You have the experience of the sensation of thinking abstractly about something. But you're going inside the experience of having a sensation. Or you're going inside the experience of experiencing the air coming in, coming out. Or you have experience of the sound, you hearing the sound. And you have the experience that it's gone. It's there, it's gone. So the inquiry is actually noticing experientially the characteristics. I mean, later in the week, I will bring a questioning meditation. But that questioning, again, won't be intellectual, won't be abstract. It will be asking questions just in terms of questioning, just in the doing of it. So it's more what I would call an experiential inquiry into the moment. So that.
It's a bit difficult to understand what you to look inside. I mean, is it.
Okay, you have a pain in the knee.
Yeah.
You have a pain in the knee. And you can be here. I have this pain in this knee. This is my pain in my knee. This is terrible. This is awful. What if the leg falls off or whatever? You go on with it. Or you go inside the knee. And you don't name it. You don't name. You just go inside the sensation. And then generally what you experience is something which is not fixed and solid, but it's kind of like moving. So with sensation, that's the way we describe it. With the breath, if you go, for example, at the nostril, you can notice the air comes cooler, comes out warmer. Just to notice that. You can also, in a way, question in some way, but this is very light. If you just look into this air that you breathe, what is this air I am breathing experientially? Actually, I am breathing your air. So your air goes into my lung, my air goes into your lung. And generally we don't think it that way. But experientially that's what's going on. So that makes sense. I know this is much harder, I mean I think it's much harder to explain the vipassana aspect than the samatha, than the focus.
So the difference between them.
Yeah, it's very light. It's not
conceptually, but what you do is harder to understand.
The doing, I think, is just for Stephen.
No.
He's going, being there, being at the moment. I'll talk a little more, maybe what I say this evening will be a little clearer for what I mean.
Aaron, you had a question? This has to be the last question. We've already passed time.
Also, it's how you think about it. It's not what you think, it's how you think about it. And also, it's your relationship to your thinking. You see, if you, I'll talk more about this tonight. It's more, do you identify with what you think? Do you believe totally what you think? Do you get lost in what you think? Or do you, to me, purpose of meditation effect is to bring spaciousness into your thinking. So that if you want to think, you can. If you don't want to think, you can. But in such a way that it does not repress it. And also that it becomes more creative. It becomes more less fixed, less repetitive.
So would you say it's mostly regarding the relationship?
Well, it's seeing what you think. Seeing what you think. What do we think? Generally, we don't know what we think. Because we caught up in it. And I would say meditation helps us to think of what do I think? I would even say, how do I think? what words do I use? To me, this is very interesting, the inner language. How do I talk to myself? How do I talk to myself about other people? How do I treat myself and other people in my thoughts? So first is to see what I think. This, I think, is very important.
And the response to such a question like, how do I think?
Yes, yeah. You use awareness, consciousness to see. I mean, but also at the same time, what is interesting in meditation, if you focus on thinking, you won't be thinking. Try it. You sit in meditation, I'm going to see my thoughts. No thoughts. If you look at them, they're not there. But generally, they don't last too long, then they come up. So generally, I would say you see the thought afterwards. Or you see the thought toward the end of it. And you look, what is it I'm telling myself? And what I would then ask often a question, is this true? Is it helpful? Where is this going to lead me? But I'll talk more really about this tonight, and then we can also have a longer, possibly, discussion about that. And it'll become clearer to rest. If that's okay. Mm-hmm. I see that it's, we've kind of really gone over the 7 minutes over.
Yes,
so I'm sorry, because I can see there are lots of questions coming up. And we'll have to, that's the time we choose to have, and we'll have to also try maybe a shorter response so there can be more questions. Thank you very much. And so, going back to the silence and continuing with the meditative awareness. And then...